This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Election year wild cards. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As we reach the final weekend before the Iowa caucuses on Monday, we'll examine the factors that could completely alter the presidential campaigns.
On the tech front, IBM has announced a major move to help the industry defend against so-called patent trolls.
With the Super Bowl in mind, the official whose crew missed a critical pass interference call in last year's playoffs is refereeing the big game on Sunday.
And gun makers have a new target customer, women and first-time buyers.
Guns being designed for women, clothing being designed for women, holsters being designed for women. In the past, gun makers and accessory makers would simply slap a different color on something and then call it for women, you know, so they'd make a pink holster or something.
Cameron McWhirter at the Wall Street Journal on where gun makers see a new source of revenue. Maybe it will be smooth sailing to the U.S. elections on November 3rd with no upsets or surprises. If polls are accurate, frontrunner Joe Biden will win the Democratic nomination and face off against President Trump in a tight contest. But what if there are some wrinkles along the way? We're joined now by Rick Newman, senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. Rick, how do you see it?
Well, things might go very smoothly from here until November 3rd with no surprises or disruptions. Or there could be some surprises, so I'm just trying to think ahead and make some guesses about what some of those surprises might be. And we started off the year with an indication that one of them might be Iran, something Iran might do. So for the time being, it appears that the United States and Iran have sort of settled their differences. There was the U.S. airstrike on the Iranian general, and then Iran retaliated with the missile strikes against a couple of bases in Iraq that host U.S. soldiers. But that may not be all of it. Iran is very well known for conducting what the Pentagon calls asymmetric warfare. That's not traditional warfare with tanks and airplanes, but terrorist attacks using militias outside of Iran, other places in the Middle East. And Iran has actually gone fairly far afield in the past. They bombed a couple of sites in Argentina back in the early 90s. So we could get some late surprise by Iran. It might not happen for months, and it might not happen at all. I hope it doesn't. I hope that nothing happens.
Yeah.
But it seems quite plausible that Iran is not finished here, and it may have something in mind that it's not going to acknowledge, something that will not have Iranian fingerprints on it.
Mm. It's certainly not over or far from over, as you point out, right? Some will say they've been at war with us for 40 years, right? So
right, that's correct.
They're not going
right.
Quiet. You said also John Bolton. How does he factor in?
Well, Bolton's going to have something to say before the election. There's this whole question of whether he might testify in the impeachment trial in the Senate. But even if he doesn't, he's got a book coming out. It's coming out this year before the election. And if he has anything to say about Trump, he's going to say it. I mean, I think it's fair to say he has teased the idea that he has kind of inside knowledge that the American public would be very interested in. Of course, part of what he's doing is trying to generate interest in his book. But once his book comes out, he's going to be blabbing all over the place. Now, that doesn't mean he's necessarily going to be trashing Trump. He may not trash Trump, but he is going to have his say. And if he knows something that's not already, you know, part of what's a pretty detailed public record on what happened with Ukraine, the whole reason Trump got impeached, Americans are going to know it. And if John Bolton, for some reason, would actually campaign against Trump, that could make a dent.
Hmm. We're speaking with Rick Newman, senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. He's written a piece about wild cards in the 2020 election. Also, his tax returns. This is still a thing now, what more than 3 years in?
It's still a thing. I know people probably are thinking, enough with the tax returns. Move on already. However, this is working its way through the court, and the Supreme Court has finally agreed to hear these legal cases on whether the House of Representatives and the Manhattan District Attorney have a right to Trump's financial records. And legal experts say the case is strong that the plaintiffs in this case, which is the House of Representatives and the Manhattan District Attorney, have a good case for why they should be able to get access to Trump's financial records. So will it make a difference? Some people think, what, you know, who cares? No one cares at this point. I don't think that's quite right. I think if we do see Trump's tax records, and it turns out that his effective tax rate is, you know, in the low single digits or even zero, you know, most working Americans pay taxes. And the average effective tax rate for American workers is around 10%. And if it turns out that Trump is earning, you know, a couple hundred million dollars a year and paying less, a lower percentage in taxes than the average worker, I think that's a liability for him. And remember, Trump is on thin ice to start with an approval rating that has is in the low 40s, and it's already looking like a close call for his reelection. So anything that just works against him, even a little bit at the margins, could be decisive in November.
What was the point you made about old hearts?
Well, we got many old candidates in this race. Trump is 73 right now, and he appears healthy, but he did make an unexplained visit to Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. last fall. And then on the Democratic side, you know, a lot of the candidates are old, too. Joe Biden is 77, Bernie Sanders is 78, and Elizabeth Warren is 70. So if any one of these candidates would have some kind of health problem requiring them to withdraw, it would just change the nature of the race. And I think that's most true of Trump.
Thanks, Rick. Rick Newman, senior columnist at Yahoo Finance, based in New York. It is 12 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Now that Human Resources VP Ashley Campbell has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, she's managing her workforce like a rock star. She even has her own hype song.
I'm the spark before the fire. I'm the power in the train. I
have a really diverse workforce with different hours, skill sets, and pay grades.
Don't stop. I'm the dream and you should know that.
Now we're motivating and engaging the right people. Every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
Vintage baseball cards, antique coins, and rare comic books. Originally bought for pennies, now regularly sell for millions of dollars, sending enthusiasts in pursuit of the next hot collectible, retro video games. It's a story by Jason Bailey, senior staff editor at the New York Times. Jason, what's trending?
If you pay any attention to kind of the video game world, which I try to keep track of, over the last year or so, there have been really expensive sales on the video game market in both auctions and private sales. Some have broke six figures, perhaps for the first time. And as I dug into it, I uncovered that a lot of collectors from other markets that are more mature, like comic books, sports cards, rare coins, are moving into the video game market, hoping that they can kind of get in on the ground floor of this collectible and get in while prices are low and hope they continue to rise as people invest in, you know, products that they may have played as children, have some nostalgia for, and think will rise in value.
Boy, how vintage is vintage when we talk about this stuff, Jason?
Yeah, so when you're looking at the video game market, initially Atari is kind of the first console, and there was some interest in collecting Atari games from the 80s at some point, but now the focus really is on the Nintendo Entertainment System, that gray console that many people probably played in the 80s and 90s. Interest is there because that's the console that really opened the market up in the United States and introduced characters like Mario and Link from The Legend of Zelda and Mega Man to people. So there's a lot of nostalgia. People who are in their 30s and 40s and may have played these games as kids now have disposable income and are looking to invest in something that they have a personal attachment to.
Wow. Who'd you find has sold some stuff for big bucks?
Yeah, so the really big sale was about a year ago. A copy of Super Mario Brothers, the first game where Mario has to go through and jump on Goombas and defeat Bowser sold for a little more than $100,000 in a private sale. That really turned heads. And the key there is that this particular copy was from an original test market in either New York or Los Angeles and was sealed with a tiny black sticker and has never been opened since. So this game came out 35 years ago and has never been opened, and its rarity and its condition is what really gave it its value. So people who have a copy of Super Mario Brothers laying around, it's certainly, almost certainly not worth that much, but this particular copy was highly coveted because of those attributes.
Wow. We're speaking with Jason Bailey, senior staff editor at the New York Times. This piece is called Collectors Are Spending Thousands on Video Games They Will Never Play. Is the trick here to have these things still unopened?
Yeah, that's the big thing of the moment, are these sealed games, particularly the sealed NES games. So, and not just unopened, but in the original shrink wrap, the original plastic that the game came in, to show that nobody's touched it, nobody's played it, and that's kind of where the headline from the article comes in. If you buy one of these games, you're never going to open it, because yeah, as soon as you open it, it loses most of its value, just Jeez. As a new car does when you take it off the lot.
That's something. So there are at least a couple of guys who seem to be like pouring big bucks into this stuff, right? But getting a good return on investment.
Yeah, people have been able to really flip games over the last year because the market's rising so quickly. And it's impossible to tell if it's a bubble or if it's going to continue to rise. But some people are just getting in and out really fast to make a quick profit. Some people are, you know, one person I talked to in the article, he had some investors put in more than $1 million to buy these sealed games with hope that over the next 10, 20 years, they'll be able to increase their return. Because that is something you've seen with comic books, for example, over the last 30 years, they have risen substantially in value.
What does that mean, say, for today's downloaded games? Like if you play, you know, Xbox or something, do they have zero value?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's competing opinions on whether the fact that so many games are downloaded now will help the retro gaming market there will be some nostalgia for the physical cartridge or the physical box, or if it will make it irrelevant in collectors' minds in the future. So it's unclear from that standpoint. Games now are unlikely to be ever worth a lot of money because they're mass-produced and because people who are aware that they could be worth something are saving them unopened, whereas 30 years ago that wasn't happening.
And that's what's
making them in perfect condition so unusual.
Thanks, Jason. Jason Bailey, senior staff editor at the New York Times. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. At the nation's largest gun trade show recently, gun makers made a big pitch for women and first-time buyers interested in carrying concealed guns, groups they say are growing. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
At the largest gun show in the country, the focus is on women and first-time buyers. As Cameron McWhorter of the Wall Street Journal tells us, the Shooting Hunting Outdoor Trade Show is showcasing small, lightweight, and concealable guns. Cameron, what had the show been trying to sell before this?
Well, I mean, they've always sold a variety of weapons, but certainly in the past, or firearms, in the past, there'd been, or certainly in recent years, there's been a heavy focus on rifles, AR-15s, that sort of caliber rifle. And now that market has sort of stalled. So they're starting to move more toward lighter weight pistols and trying to find a new demographic. And of course, their argument is that young women who need protection should be buying handguns, small handguns that are concealable. The concealed carry market has been exploding as the various states are pushing for. There have been numerous states that have made it much more easy for people to have concealed weapons in recent years.
Has their message affected the target audience they're trying to get to?
It appears, I mean, at this show, there was definitely, I ran into a fashion line where called Tactica Defense Fashion, which is, you know, they have sweaters and holsters and things that are trying to look fashionable. I'm not a judge of that one way or another, but you can conceal your handgun. They are creating weapons, guns that are very, very, very light, very easy to shoot. Even if you're not an expert, you don't have to go to a rifle range or a pistol range to figure this stuff out. You just point and shoot. Some of them have laser pointers on them, so you just point the red dot and fire. And this is all geared to the person who wants to have personal protection but doesn't necessarily want to go to the the pistol range all the time.
We're speaking with Cameron McWhorter of the Wall Street Journal. Cameron, what is the demographic of the people who go to a show like this?
Well, I mean, I think we can all have our own impression, which is older white guys with beards, basically. And that's that demographic was there in force, certainly in Las Vegas where I was. But there also is increasingly more and more women showing up. And that is certainly a demographic that the industry is trying to court. Not just women, also older people who are concerned about protection. And so a lot of these guns, the same reason these guns are good for women, they're also good for older people or people who have arthritis. Or, you know, these are easy to carry, easy to shoot, and you don't need a lot of training.
Are they using women to market to women and try to persuade women that they should be carrying?
Yeah, I mean, in the past, certainly the gun industry used women to market their weapons in a way that was very old school, sort of, you know, women wearing bikinis, holding guns and stuff like that on their calendars and things like that. That is sort of on its way out. And what you're seeing instead is much more guns being designed for women, clothing being designed for women, holsters being designed for women. A lot of the women that I spoke to at this show were saying that in the past, gun makers and accessory makers would simply slap a different color on something and then call it for women. You know, so they'd make a pink holster or something. And that just isn't, the women were saying they want something designed for their bodies so that it's easier to conceal a weapon. They want something developed, so a gun developed that's easier for them to use as opposed to just anybody.
Is there concern, especially among gun control advocates, that the people buying these guns won't have any idea how to use them?
Well, I think there's a concern that more among gun control proponents that more guns means more violence. So if you have more guns in the area, people are going to steal those guns and use those guns inappropriately, or that's their concern. And they're very strongly argue that. Of course, Second Amendment advocates argue the opposite, which is that more people who have guns keep people who are thinking about doing bad things from doing them because they don't know who has a gun. That debate has gone on and on for decades among all kinds of people and academics, and that will continue. The debate's not going to change.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhorter with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Your credit card probably gives you 1% cash back, but what does your bank account give you? Most banks give you 0.1% APY interest on your savings, but you should be earning more. With the Wealthfront Cash Account, you earn more interest on your money. They have one of the highest interest rates in the market at 1.78% annual percentage yield. That's 18 times more interest than the national average of 0.1%, according to Bankrate.com. And it's so fast and easy to get started. It only takes a dollar and a few minutes to open an account. You can even do it right from your phone. No paperwork required. Plus, there are no fees, and your money is FDIC insured up to $1 million through their partner banks. Right now, you can sign up for the Wealthfront Cash Account in less than 5 minutes by visiting wealthfront.com/Gordon. Go to wealthfront.com/Gordon and start earning 18 times more interest on all your savings. That's wealthfront.com/Gordon. Wealthfront is not a bank. Cash Account is offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. Wealthfront conveys funds to partner banks who accept and maintain deposits, provide the interest rate, and provide FDIC insurance. The APY is subject to change. First full weekend in February. Welcome aboard. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, 5 freedoms tied to personal finance. Brandon Copeland of the Jets talks Super Bowl and money matters. And while you might recognize the officiating crew at Sunday's Super Bowl, we'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Thanks for being with us. IBM has announced a major move to help the tech industry defend against so-called patent trolls. The company is pledging a substantial amount of its intellectual property to that defense. Here's what it means from tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Rob, first off, what's a patent troll?
Patent troll is a company that buys lots of patents on the cheap and then sits on those patents doesn't really invest in them, doesn't try to build anything with them. They just sit on them quietly, and they wait until somebody else builds a product, takes it to market, and then starts making money. And then they show up with their hand out and saying, okay, that's my patent you're violating. Pay me some money. And so it's kind of legal extortion. So it's a big problem for the industry because you've got, you know, lots of little startups that don't make it, big companies that don't use the patents and sell the patents off. And these patent trolls buy these things for pennies on the dollar and then come back and haunt you with those patents when you finally decide to develop something of your own, having no knowledge that patent existed.
Yeah. All right. So IBM is doing what here to try to help itself and perhaps others in that, in its industry? IBM
is one of the largest patent holders. They've got hundreds of thousands of patents, 140,000 going back to 1920. And so they took their patents and they put them into the LOT network. And the LOT network is a network of companies. They take a large portion of their patent portfolios, they put them in the network, and then if those patents are ever sold, there are conditions that go with those, the licenses on the patents that say, hey, you can sue anybody but those people that are in the LOT network. So if you're in the network and you contributed, they cannot sue you if you violate any of those patents. And so it provides a level of protection for folks that generate patents from people that buy the patents and use them against them.
How is IBM doing this, I guess? Is there a financial pledge here too, or they're tossing in time and energy?
Well, they're tossing in the patent. So thousands upon thousands of patents go into this, and so IBM contributed 80,000 patents into the network. And so, and that's a significant portion of their overall portfolio. And the end result is those patents now cannot be used against anybody else in the LOT network.
Speaking with Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece entitled IBM Takes Major Step Against Patent Trolls. Did you say that... Man, lawsuits have increased 500% the past 10 years?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lucrative business for the companies that are in it. These patent troll companies are pretty much staffed by attorneys, so their entire business is suing people or threatening to sue them to get royalties on the patents that they have. So it's a very lucrative business. I mean, you can buy patents, as I say, for pennies on the dollar from companies that are going broke or for companies that aren't using the patents. And as I say, just sit on them as a long-term investment and then kind of prey on the people that are actually developing real products. It's an unfortunate situation. It's an abuse of the patent system in the United States, and it's unfortunate, but LOT is one of the organizations that have been set up to fight that.
And what are you basically guessing the types of things that might be needed or required in the future, and you just kind of develop a patent for it regardless?
That's kind of it. Is and remember, it can take years to get a patent approved. I mean, you can patent pending means that your patent is being considered, and a lot of times startups never make it to the point where they get a patent granted before they fail. So it is a long process. So the end result is I mean, how do you know 10 years from now what you're going to develop, and then know enough about it to put in place a patent to protect that future product? We're not capable of thinking that way. So that's why this is a problem, is there are a lot of people out there thinking up ideas that never make it to market, and then poor sucker that finally figures out how to make an idea work, they're the ones that pay the freight.
You suspect this will help?
Yeah, it'll help a lot. This makes it harder and harder for patent trolls to make money, and the hope is enough companies do this, the patent troll business process will fail, and so the patent trolls will go away, and we can go back to actually building products that people want to buy.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. There's a park in New York City called Franklin D. Roosevelt Four Freedoms Park. It's named after a 1941 FDR speech where he articulated four essential human freedoms and identified them as freedom of speech, of worship, from fear, and from want. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com, says our pursuit of money is also about a hunger for freedom, with five dimensions. Jonathan, explain.
I was thinking about what does it mean to be financially free, and inspired in part by a piece I wrote the week before about this survey put out by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And what it found was the biggest driver of people's sense of financial well-being was simply, you know, how much money they had in the bank. And so that brought me to my first notion of freedom, which is this freedom from fear, this freedom that, you know, we're not going to fall off the financial ledge at any particular moment because we get hit with unexpected expenses or because we're suddenly out of a job. And we can put these fears at bay simply by keeping perhaps $5,000 in a savings account or in a checking account. I know that'll sound like a lot of money to people, but putting that money into a savings account or a checking account, just leaving it there will probably buy you more happiness than taking that $5,000 and heading to the shopping mall.
Yeah, because kind of you take away perhaps a daily fear that you might have.
You know, worrying about money is a huge preoccupation for the typical American. I remember talking to a couples therapist, and this couples therapist told me that the number one reason couples end up in therapy, at least based on her experience, was because of money.
Yeah.
Money is a huge source of anxiety. It's a huge source of conflict in relations, and you want to do your best to get beyond those daily worries. And the solution may be just getting a few thousand dollars in that bank account.
The root of all evil, right? I mean, sometimes of our own making.
Of our own making, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, if we spend too much and don't and have very little financial leeway in our monthly budgets, we're going to be the ones that suffer. And so that brings me to another of the fears that I mentioned in the piece, which is freedom from our own wants. Among psychologists, this is a great word. I only learned it last year. It's called miswanting. And the notion of miswanting is that we hanker after this stuff that we think is going to make us endlessly happy, and yet often it gives us only the briefest of thrills. And if we want to have some sense of financial freedom, one of the things we've got to do is to liberate ourselves from this miswanting, from our own desires that are unlikely to make us happy. And if we do that, if we manage to be more thoughtful in the way we spend our money, we will buy ourselves this financial cushion every month where we can easily meet the bills and we won't have that level of anxiety.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece entitled Five Freedoms. Talk about to financial dependence, freedom from that.
So when you think about financial dependence, what we're talking about here is that you are relying on other people or other institutions in order to get through the month. So you might be relying on Social Security, or might be relying on charity, you might be relying on family members in order to be able to cover the bills, and that sort of financial dependence doesn't feel great. I'm not saying you should turn down your Social Security check, but you don't want to be wholly dependent on that Social Security check. But I would take this notion of financial dependence one step further. If you're an employee, in some sense you are financially dependent on your employer. I mean, you can always go and get another job somewhere else, but the fact is, you know, you are expected to turn up at work Monday to Friday. You are expected to put in those hours, and if you don't, then you could find yourself out of a job. And if you have a nice boss, that's fine. But if you've got a boss who's difficult to deal with, that financial dependence does not feel great.
Yeah.
And what you really want to do is to save and invest so you can free yourself from that.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com.
Now that Human Resources Director Fernando Pino has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, he's completely crushing it. He even has his own hype song.
Supporting our entire workforce. Everyone has different hours, skill sets, and pay grades.
I'm on the top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top, top, I'm gonna rise up.
Motivating and engaging our people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
I'm on the top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top, top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top.
Thanks for being with us. How about personal finance instruction from a professional athlete? New York Jets linebacker Brandon Copeland is in his second year teaching a financial literacy course at his alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, and has partnered with Capital One to launch the Mind Over Money study. Teaching finance has become a passion. He's with us now. Brandon, how'd you get interested in personal finance?
I think wanting to ultimately create a financially secure lifestyle for myself and my family, right? Like, ultimately, growing up, you think about what you want, and a lot of us are chasing this money and this lifestyle. And for me, I've really tried to hone in on, like, what type of lifestyle that I want to provide for myself and my family. And it's not just about keeping that, the stuff that I've learned to myself. It's about sharing that with everyone else.
You seem to have come to the table with a lot of that knowledge already. Did you learn finances from home, or did you have a good program like in high school?
No, not at all, to be quite honest with you. Not to downplay my mother like that, but I did learn budgeting, though. That's one thing I can say. My mom did a great job of sticking to a budget, keeping us from eating extra candy bars at the checkout aisle. Right. But growing up, I think I've literally just put in the time, to be quite honest with you. I've interned at multiple financial firms. I've interned literally in the off season of while playing football. Like, instead of teaching, I would be interning at hedge funds and stuff like that, just learning more things. And it's just kind of shaped itself into this. And again, I'm all about sharing. And I think that that's why the partnership with Capital One and the Mind Over Money study is makes so much sense, because they're trying to make this stuff accessible to all. It shouldn't just stick with undergrad students at Penn.
Yeah.
It should be accessible to everyone.
What did you find in your first year in the classroom as you were talking to these undergrads at Penn? What did anything stand out as you were trying to kind of go through financial literacy?
Yeah, 100%. I think that, you know, when you talk about financial literacy and some of these topics, you think that it's not necessarily affecting the kids now. Actually, the students now, and really all of these things are. So even though we went over how to buy a house, right, and the cost of renting, I'm thinking, like, you know, most students aren't about to buy a house anytime soon, but a lot of the questions that they were asking were about their current living situation. Do I have to pay my landlord now, right, if my roof has been leaking for the last 3 months, right? Another thing that we found was literally, and it was also through the Mind Over Money study, is like 58% of people feel that finances actually control their lives. And so how do you actually deal with the stress that is a constant of life and making the sound financial decisions for your long-term future?
We're speaking with Brandon Copeland. He's a linebacker for the New York Jets, about to start his second season as a professor, rather, of financial literacy at the University of Pennsylvania. That's his alma mater. Two quick questions before we finish up about football. Chiefs or Niners?
Ooh, great question. I want the Chiefs to win. I want the Chiefs to win. I think the 49ers defense will stop them, though.
Yeah.
So, and what about you? I'm curious to know your thoughts.
I think the Niners are balanced enough to do it. I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, I agree.
Second question. I'm a Jets season ticket holder. I got three tickets. Are you telling me, or please tell me that it's gonna be worth it to hang on to them?
Hang on to them. I'm telling you, I know you've heard that the last 50 years, but hang on to them. I promise you that the ship is being put into the right direction. Again, we finished the year strong, 6-2, and clearly, you know, there's going to be that transition period, that growth period. We had a lot of injuries, so a lot of people don't account for it, right? So hang on to them. I'm very excited for this 2020 season.
Nice, Brandon. Brandon Copeland from the New York Jets with Capital One. He's got the Mind Over Money study. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Most astonishing pregame storylines in Super Bowl 54. Bill Vinovich, whose officiating crew was responsible for what's widely considered the worst blown call in NFL playoff history last year, will ref the game Sunday between the Chiefs and Niners. With time running out, you'll recall Vinovich's crew missed an obvious pass interference infraction by the Rams, and the no call essentially cost the Saints a trip to the Super Bowl.
Pass is incomplete. No flag for Tommy Lee Lewis. Talk to each other. Crowd's going crazy as there's no flag right on the Saints sideline.
Vinovich, 58 years old, refereeing now his second Super Bowl in 5 years. He can't publicly comment on the improbable turn of events since officials are off limits to the news media. But social media has had plenty to say. When the league named Vinovich, Saints receiver Michael Thomas wrote on his Twitter account, "Oh no, quote, he don't even own any flags to throw." That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.